Hey there, Rick Singeri of Vermont Edition. Just want you to know this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. On December 22nd, Vermont will get a new commissioner of the Department of Corrections. Lisa Menard is stepping down, and into her position comes Mike Touchette. Touchette has worked for DOC for nearly three decades, starting as a prison guard, more correctly, and officially known as a correctional officer. And he thinks the department is doing some good work with Vermont inmates. But there is work yet to be done as well, which he acknowledges. From making sure that people serving time in Vermont prisons have access to medication for opioid dependence as required by law, to treating an increasingly aging population, to dealing with also increasing mental health disorders. The demands on Vermont's prison system are increasing, and a couple hundred Vermont prisoners are still serving their sentences out of state, despite people of all political persuasions wanting to have them back in Vermont. Today in the show, we're going to talk with the incoming commissioner about what the department does well and what it needs to improve upon, and he'll take your questions and comments. Mike Touchette, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
So can you describe a little bit of your timeline, your history with the department, and how you got from 28 years ago to today?
Sure. Well, it's been quite an experience, and it's been one that's been full of wonderful opportunities. As you mentioned, I started as a correctional officer at the Rutland Regional Correctional Facility back then, back in 1990. I'm originally from the Chittenden County area, and once my wife finished her college down in that county, we wanted to move back closer to home and family, so we moved back up to Chittenden County, where I took a job at the Chittenden Regional Correctional Facility, also as a correctional officer one. Soon they're promoted to a correctional officer two.
What's the difference?
A bit more authority and responsibility. It has some general oversight of correctional officer ones, but not full supervision of them, at least at that time. From a CO2, I went a very short, very brief period of time as an acting shift supervisor before I was promoted to, at the time, what was called a correctional officer three. And that was an officer who worked in the community at the probation and parole office, providing supervision to offenders serving their time in the community. I think I did that for 5 years or so before I was promoted to the community correctional officer supervisor. The CO3's name changed to community correctional officers from CO3. It was much more appropriate. It was, better represented the work that we were actually doing. From there, I went to a corrections program supervisor, and a program supervisor does direct supervision of probation and parole officers, but at the time, we also oversaw specific risk reduction programs. I had two programs during my term as a program supervisor. One was the ISAP, or Intensive Substance Abuse Program, and the other, we took an initiative in Burlington in recognition of gender differences. We had all female offenders serving time in the community under one group of people under my supervision. So those were the two primary groups that I worked with there. I then moved to a field operations manager, and that provided support and supervision to all the probation officers across the state, and particularly the caseworkers in support of their work, which is very challenging work, and they do an incredible job. Then I went to the director of correctional facilities, director of facility operations, and that has direct management oversight of at the time when I started, we had seven correctional facilities, and with the loss of Windsor, we're now down to six correctional facilities here in the state of Vermont. It was an incredible learning experience for me, not only from the management perspective and understanding all of the nuances and intricacies of what happens in the facilities. You're really talking about a city in its own, and all of the support and services and resources that we would find in the community, you have to have available primarily in those facilities too. And trying to maintain those systems and those operations can be a real challenge at times. Then about a year and 8 months ago, I guess it was, the governor appointed me as the deputy commissioner. Also a great learning experience, and under the tutelage of Commissioner Menard and her wealth of knowledge and experience, I've learned an awful lot. And I'm really looking forward to this new and exciting opportunity to lead the Department of Corrections in the coming years.
Well, you've been in a lot of different positions, as you outlined, in the Department of Corrections, and starting with a correctional officer position. So you know what that's like. You know what it's like to supervise. But this is a different kind of job. I mean, in a lot of ways, being a commissioner, while you are making decisions and working as sort of an overseer of a department, it's also a political position.
Certainly.
Does that appeal to you?
It has some certain appeal to me. There's no question that sometimes politics can be not only intimidating but frustrating at times.
You don't say.
Yeah, right. I think one of the exciting opportunities here, though, is because of my experience and having some real foundation in the roots and the operations of the Department of Corrections and the great work that we truly do. That brings an opportunity to the political table that even Commissioner Menard herself has had, as she also experienced a great career in corrections.
So let me ask you first about some of the things that you think that the Corrections Department does well, that we do well in terms of how Vermont's prisons are run, how the whole system, I mean, it goes beyond just the actual prison facilities we have. It's much greater of a system than that. What do you think we do well?
There's an awful lot that we do well, and we could spend probably hours talking about this. I'm going to do my best to summarize some of the real highlights here. COSA program,
that's Circles of Support and Accountability,
recently had a documentary done by Bess O'Brien, Coming Home, that highlighted not only the successes of the program in supporting inmates or offenders returning to the community, but it also demonstrates the power of the community and how they can become involved in reducing recidivism and helping offenders who oftentimes may lack resources or supports to be successful in the community. It really allows them the opportunity to be involved. It's an incredibly fulfilling opportunity, much like our reparative boards, also a citizen-driven and managed program where in lieu of going to court, an offender is responsible for their actions, not only to the victim, but also to their own community. It really puts the onus on the offender to recognize the harm that they've done, not only to an individual or a business, certainly in their people associated with businesses, but it also talks about, you know, how it's impacted their families, how it's impacted their communities. It's an incredibly powerful process and, again, a great opportunity for Vermont citizens to become involved in the judicial process, and it has incredible outcomes. I've sat in on quite a few of those boards as part of my work in the Probation and Parole Office, and I was never ceased to be amazed by not only the investment by the community members, but the impact it had with the people that were participating in the program and the valuable lessons that they've learned through those programs.
I know another one that you want to mention is a relatively new program of peer support within inside of a correctional facility.
Yep.
And it's called Open Ears.
It is.
And so prisoners are sort of counseling and advising other prisoners. There's a way to look at that as a really good thing because peer support we've seen in other arenas as well has been shown to be a really good kind of support system. There's another way to look at it to say you don't have the resources to have actual enough therapists, enough counseling, enough mental health facilities that now you're asking other inmates to do the work.
That's a fair
point.
So
how do you assess that program?
I would assess the program out of the gate as beyond our wildest imaginations. We often kind of gauge our culture and the health of our culture by grievances or lawsuits or complaints that we receive. We have received countless letters from offenders who are not coaches in this case, but are actually the recipients of the coach's work, who have thanked the department for having this program. Just to be clear, so it is called Open Ears, and it's called Open Ears because the original group that was trained, the forensic supporters, the inmates that are involved in this program were given the opportunity to name the program. They opened that, and I think it's quite appropriate. It's really a platform for people to listen and share similar lived experiences, and that goes a long way. Particularly for people that are coming into the prisons who this may be their first time, it can be incredibly overwhelming. Having somebody who's lived that experience kind of help them talk through it, think about how they can manage the stress and think in a positive way going forward has really had some incredible benefits.
What do they talk about? What are the kinds of things in the peer support system that are discussed?
It can be any, again, so somebody coming into the correctional facility who has never been there before, you know, it's a foreign place. And you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of broadcasts out there that kind of show what prison life is like. It's not necessarily what's true here in Vermont. So the open ears coaches can certainly help them understand how to navigate the correctional system, how to access services, how they can contact their family members, contact their attorneys. They also talk about everything from daily stresses, ongoing chronic mental illness, depression. They are not there to provide clinical counseling, and they're not there to provide any sort of legal counsel. They are really a platform as a peer to be able to listen, understand, again, with those shared lived experiences and make a connection with them. What's also an indicator of the success of this is we recognize that this is a brand new, really kind of a progressive program we've never looked at here in the Department of Corrections. And we certainly had staff, myself included, that were thinking, this is beyond what we do. And we're focused on security and safety. And when we allow inmates to kind of travel freely and talk with other inmates, we lose some control there. And again, one of the indicators of success is we've actually had testimonies from several officers who were completely against this program saying, while they're not 100% convinced of this, they have certainly seen the benefits of this. What's nice to know, or it's what's hard to really kind of put a data value on, is how many incidents have not occurred as a result of the interaction that these open ears coaches have had, whereas in similar cases without the open ears coaches, some of the inmates may have chosen to go a different route and have gotten themselves in trouble.
Like what? What are you thinking of specifically that that being a part of the open ears program prevents? I mean, just kind of squabbles, skirmishes, physical violence.
On occasion, we'll have people that will cover their windows and their cell doors so we can't have observation of them. And obviously, that becomes a concern for us. In a situation like that, depending on the situation and the severity of the situation, if we can see that somebody's really struggling and having a hard time, we'll get an open ears coach there before it gets to that point. So it's hard to say that we've reduced the number of incidents by X value, but we know it's certainly had some impact. The coaches themselves would tell you this has been a life-altering experience. It's brought meaning and value. They recognize that while they certainly have a criminal history, that criminal history doesn't necessarily define them as a human being, that they have a lot to offer. And I think they are certainly demonstrating their ability to contribute not only while they're incarcerated, but we're also looking to move this into the community through the recovery centers. And great opportunities for people to stay connected in the community. And certainly the research would indicate that people that are returning to the community that have good supports are more likely to be successful. We feel strongly that by moving this program into the community, that will leverage even greater opportunities for success.
Tim is calling in from Waterville. Hi, Tim. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
First of all, I want to say to Mr. Touchette, I certainly hope that this is a change for the better. I'm an advocate for prisoners and those who are on supervision in the community. I've heard from inmates who are in Mississippi that they're being denied medications, that their seizure medications are not being administered to them, that medical requests are not being responded to. The response from folks at central office was, well, they should just grieve that fact that they're not getting their medications. The problem with the grievance is that, as Mr. Touchette knows, that can take up to sometimes 3 to 6 weeks to be resolved. In the meantime, seizure medications aren't being administered, heart medications aren't being administered. So I'm wondering how the department intends to go forward and resolve these little hiccups that seem to be developing in Mississippi.
Tim, thanks for the call. And Mike Touchette, I'll remind our listeners that we have a new contract for out-of-state prisoners who were recently moved this fall from a prison in Pennsylvania to one in Mississippi. So this is still a fairly new, fairly recent, couple months old move. Tim is saying what he's hearing is that prisoners aren't getting medications, not just medication related to opioid addiction therapy, which is another area that we'll talk about later, but all kinds of medications. And the process for getting that fixed can take a long time.
Tim, thank you for the question or comments, really. I couldn't agree with you more. Our current grievance process is slow and cumbersome. We are rewriting that in acknowledgement that it should not take as long as the current policy allows for a grievance to be resolved. There certainly are opportunities for somebody to elevate a grievance to an emergency grievance that when there is a life-threatening or life-altering circumstance at play that allows an inmate to escalate that. In response to the medications, one of the advantages that we have in this particular contract that we didn't have in Pennsylvania is our health services contract here in Vermont now have direct access to the electronic health record. So when these complaints do come in, we're not reliant on the receiving state to send us information about the case. We can actually in real time get into that inmate's electronic health record and understand what services have been provided, what might be in the queue, are there pending appointments, are there changes in medications that that were either appropriate or warrant further discussion. That is not something that we had in Pennsylvania and will certainly allow us to, but in a more timely way and more efficient way, understand the health care needs of people that are out of state in recognition that we Vermont, don't have our own health care services staff on site all the time in the Mississippi facility.
If I were somebody who was missing my medication, it might be unclear at what point that's raised to an alarming situation, a life-altering situation, anti-seizure medication. Sure, you know, that can be a very risky situation. But
absolutely.
High cholesterol, high blood pressure medicine, I mean, is that something that I could say, look, this is about my health and my life. You need to fix this faster. I mean, at what point does a grievance rise to that ability to elevate it?
So much like in Vermont, those grievances would be evaluated by a medical professional. If it's related specifically about healthcare needs, correctional staff won't make that evaluation. We'll forward it to somebody that has that level of expertise to triage what the level of need is and the potential for any danger for the individual. So our medical staff are really kind of because of that level of expertise, they're able to understand the implications or unintended consequences if somebody's not administered medications.
Today, we're talking with incoming Corrections Commissioner Mike Touchette. He takes over just before the end of this year, and he's done many roles in his nearly 3 decades with the department. Let's talk, Mike Touchette, a little bit about medication-assisted therapy and treatment for opioid addiction in prison. A new law that was passed last session allowed for more treatment, longer treatment, for people who are in prison and coming out of prison and an attempt to make a better, smoother transition for people both coming into correctional facilities and going out of them and making sure that they were able to get treatment for as long as they needed it rather than a shorter time period for people who have been dealing with an opioid addiction. But it seems like there have been some struggles getting that rolled out and that they continue to to struggle in some ways. Is that a fair assessment?
I think it is fair. And it's fair to say that because less than 1% of jails and prisons around the country offer this type of treatment. So there's really no solid history for us to develop, to grow from. There are a couple of states that are doing this or prisons that are doing this. There's not a great deal of research and there's not a great deal of history that allows us to say here's the appropriate method of delivery of medication-assisted therapy. What's exciting about this, though, is that we are on the forefront of this. And not to disparage in any way the state of Rhode Island, who was ahead of this in many rights as far as the treatment goes. They have twice the incarcerated population as Vermont, and Vermont has twice as many people on the MAT program. Now, our protocols and criteria may be different than Rhode Island's, but I think it is indicative of the growth that we have seen. We're at 493 people as of this morning out of the 1,700 people incarcerated receiving medically assisted treatment. That's a pretty significant growth since July 1. Is it a perfect system? No. And I think what's exciting here is that exciting but frustrating at the same time is that, again, because there isn't that great wealth of experience out there, we're learning from our own mistakes. We're learning from what's working best. How are people responding? And one of the challenges going forward, it'll take some time, is to understand how effective has this treatment been. Certainly one of the primary objectives here is to reduce the number of fatalities related to overdose. And so when people are returning to the community, there's a couple measurements we'll be looking at. Well, number one is certainly are they maintaining a connection with their hub to maintain the medically assisted therapy? If for some reason they return to the correctional facility, have they returned still on MAT in good standing with their hubs? Have they stopped? Why did they stop? Trying to understand the dynamics of this disease is going to take some time. It is not a perfect process, but the people that we have working on this are fully committed to this and trying to understand all of the values and all of the challenges that come along with this and thinking about this in a way that is not only safe to do but is driven by medical necessity.
Can you repeat the statistic that you mentioned just a minute ago? Out of 1,700 plus inmates, how many are on MAT?
493 as of this morning.
That's a lot. That's almost a third.
That is correct.
What does that say to you about the level of drug addiction and how much drug addiction is driving crime and how we then criminalize drug addiction?
Well, I don't know that the MAT numbers are fully indicative of how addiction plays into crime.
Right.
We just don't have that data. I think it is.
But you must have thoughts on it. I mean, if you've worked
certainly
in this field for so long, you must have a philosophy or a sense of how that
certainly
is.
I don't think there's any question that there are quite a few people in our custody who have committed crimes as a result to sustain their habits. It is indicative of a very serious crisis here in the state of Vermont. And, you know, we're starting again from ground zero. And in a short 4 months, we've blossomed to 493 people. What we're hoping to see through the good efforts in the community and our hubs and the Vermont Department of Health and all of our partners in the effort, Opioid Coordination Council, is a reduction in people coming in the back door who are opiate dependent and will require this type of treatment.
I mentioned before that this is a political position you have, and so part of it now is, as you take the helm on the end of December, part of it is being careful about what you say, but part of it is also you have this platform now for thinking about Vermont's criminal justice system and trying to advocate for ways that it could change beyond just the structures that you're in charge of within correctional facilities and parole and probation sort of systems. So do you think that there's fundamentally a way we need to change in Vermont how we think about corrections?
I would say, well, corrections, yes. Here's where my thoughts are on corrections. Corrections is kind of the end-all, be-all. We're kind of the last stop on the train. And we want to be really good partners with the early interventions to the extent that we can, and that includes partnering with our other departments and agencies to provide support and services and data that helps us understand how do we do better early intervention with people so that they're not finding themselves not only in correction systems, but perhaps involved in other departments around the state, in DCF. I think there's a lot of opportunity for the state to, and they have been, to continue that work, to partner together to serve the needs of Vermonters so that people are healthy and have great opportunities here in the state.
Let's go to Gary, who's calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, Gary.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What are you questioning or wanting to know about?
Well, I just wanted to ask Mr. Touche a question, congratulate him on his new position. I was just wondering, I know there were talks a while back of bringing inmates back into Vermont rather than outsourcing. And I was wondering, is that still on the table? Is that still something that is in the air? Is that something that might happen down the road? Or is it still being considered so that families have an easier access that are from Vermont getting to their loved ones versus going down out of state to like Mississippi or any other state?
Gary, thanks for the call. And again, a reminder, a little over 200 inmates moved from a prison facility in Pennsylvania to one in Mississippi under a new contract that the state has with CoreCivic, which runs this prison in Mississippi. As I mentioned at the beginning, people of all political persuasions for many years now have said we want to find a way to not have Vermont prisoners serve their time out of state. And the population has been reduced over time, but still 200 people in Mississippi. Long way to travel for family members who want to stay connected. Lots of issues ongoing. We've already heard about some of them with people having to wait too long to be able to get on their medication. So what is the future?
That's a great question. Thank you, Gary. You're absolutely right. There's been discussions and there are continuing to be discussions. Again, people from all backgrounds and political backgrounds are in agreement that we want all Vermont inmates back in the state of Vermont. And the challenges that we face, obviously, that's put us in this position is a lack of space here in the state of Vermont. The administration submitted a proposal last year for a campus-style facility to be built somewhere in the northwest corridor of Vermont. We are going to be updating that report and revisiting it this session with the legislature. And what's really important here is that this will be owned and operated by the state of Vermont and the Vermont state employees. I think there was some confusion last year about who was actually going to occupy this. Just to be absolutely clear, this is a Vermont-run correctional facility. In this campus-style model, we would allow us the opportunity to essentially stop the out-of-state program en masse. And put an asterisk by that because there will always be a need for the state of Vermont to exercise some usage of out-of-state and primarily through the interstate compact. And there's a couple of examples. One, if somebody's if an individual in our custody, their security level is so high or their behavior is so unmanageable that we don't have either the facilities or the services and programs to support them to be safe and healthy, we may look at the compact. Another example is on the occasion when a Vermont law enforcement officer is convicted of a crime here in the state of Vermont and they're sentenced to a term of imprisonment, we would compact them to another state for their own safety. So we are looking forward to another conversation this year with the legislature about not only improving our opportunities for bringing these people back from out of state, but also improving the level of services and programs that can be provided to the incarcerated population.
Chloe White is policy director for the ACLU of Vermont. That's the American Civil Liberties Union, and she's on the line with us now. Hi, Chloe. Go right ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
So according to a September report from DOC, there are 704 people who are held in custody past their minimum release date, which is more than three times the number of those who are held out of state. And this includes over 100 held for lack of adequate housing. So we'd love to know, so what's DOC doing to assess whether more of these inmates could be diverted to less costly alternatives, especially since it costs so much more to incarcerate someone than to provide alternative housing or alternative programs?
Mike?
Yep. Thank you, Chloe. It's been an ongoing challenge for a number of years, and particularly, you're right, we have a population that we coin as a B1. It's just an administrative code that we use to identify this population, and those are people who are past their minimum who are eligible to be released in the community. You are absolutely right that the cost of incarceration is significant, and in many cases, I think one of our challenges that with this population is these folks have really kind of burdened every bridge that they've had, and there's not a lot of support in the community either through transitional housing, meaning that housing that the Vermont Department of Corrections pays for, or sort of subsidized housing, or programs that would, or even family members who are willing to take another chance. So I think that's where our challenge lies, in finding good opportunities that allow these people the opportunity to be in the community and gaining the foothold in the community so that they can find long-term success. It's certainly an ongoing challenge, though.
Let's go to Sarah, who's calling in from Rutland. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hello. I'm calling in reference. I had a family member in the Rutland Correctional Facility, and his medication was not given to him. And I called the caseworker repeatedly, and the caseworker got so frustrated with me that he said, "Don't ever call me again," and he hung up on me. I called his supervisor, who was surprised this had happened. I complained to the woman who visits the prisons, and she said, "Well, we don't prescribe stimulants, which is ADHD medications." So you have all these, I think quite a few people who are in jail might have ADHD, and they're not given their medications because they, even if it's prescribed before they went in, they're not allowed to have it while they're there.
So Sarah's son not able to get his medication for ADHD. What about it, Mike Pichette?
Well, I can't speak to the medical necessity of that. What I can tell you is that there are some medications generally specific to ADHD, such as Ritalin, that are very dangerous when they're abused. That we don't that is not prescribed. I am quite confident, however, that when somebody has a diagnosis and where medication has been a complement to helping that, that they are finding alternatives. So there are times when somebody's medications may change upon an incarceration period. We also have to be mindful of the real risks that are associated with some of the drugs that may find their way into a correctional facility.
That seems like a tough thing to do. You're always trying to balance the needs of an individual against the needs of a bit larger population and the whole system. I mean,
it certainly is. You know, I was thinking this morning as I was waiting for this interview about how incredibly complex the Department of Corrections is from dealing with we're basically a hospital. We provide health care to 1,700 people. We are food services. We provide support to people with significant mental health disabilities. With our geriatric population is growing, who not only have physical disabilities, may also be experiencing dementia too. It is incredible to me the amount that the department covers and does a really good job at. Are we perfect? Absolutely not. But by and large, large, and I think our colleagues around the country would say that we are doing a really very good job.
Well, Mike, consider this an entrance interview, and I'm sure we'll be speaking with you more as you take over and as other issues arise over time. We like to often keep in touch with what's happening in the Corrections Department. Mike Touchette will take over as Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Corrections on December 22nd. He's currently Deputy Commissioner, and he's worked in the department for 28 years, starting as a correctional officer. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you for having me.